Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. I want to welcome back our listeners to this week's episode of Evolving to Exceptional. We have a very experienced professional with us here today, Brian Gorman. He has been featured in Forbes. That's where I first saw one of his articles around the head, heart, and gut. He does, has done and continues to do transformational coaching in all different areas. Brian, welcome to the Evolving to Exceptional podcast. I would love if you could just take a minute to give us a little bit of your background, why it is you do what you do, and what it is that you're passionate about, and how you got to where you are.
I'm very happy to be here, Jessica. First, to make sure our listeners are clear, I am not a doctor. Head, heart, and gut, we will talk about, but not from the lens of an MD. My journey has had one common thread from my freshman year in college to today. And that thread has been the change journey. My freshman year, I started at Syracuse in 1967-68. I was an Eagle Scout. I was and still am actually an introvert, and decided that I wanted to change my relationship with the rest of the world. So I did what any good Eagle Scout introvert would do. I joined a fraternity. And I joined Alpha Phi Omega, which is the National Service Fraternity. I ended up doing youth work on the Onondaga Reservation outside of Syracuse. And at the time, the university mascot was a Native American, not surprisingly, unfortunately, but not surprisingly, portrayed by Caucasian fraternity brothers in their Hollywood attempt to dress like Indians and then running around pretending to be drunken Indians. And I tried to get the university to change its mascot, to change its portrayal of the mascot. I failed. It actually took the Onondaga Nation another 10 years. But this spark around change really was ignited in me, and at the social, at the organizational, at the personal level, that's what has fueled my career ever since.
I love that. That's such a fantastic story of change and the desire to bring about change. What do you think is, or what in your experience of working with this for all these years, is the thing that gets people hung up the most, or that causes people to struggle so much with change in general?
Our bodies, our brains. We're pattern seekers. So much of what we do in our lives is unconscious. Change requires us to be conscious and to break those patterns. Just one quick example. Even the changes we really want to make, if they're significant in any way, we begin to resist it because we start running into those obstacles that we didn't expect. We go into big change, whether it's a relationship, a new job, a new career, going to college, any big change like that, not knowing what we don't know. And when we run into those obstacles, our unconscious is really telling us, no, you really don't want to go there. You don't want to retire and move to Costa Rica, maybe retire and move to Florida, whatever the change is. And so much of getting through change is really about the mind and the body.
So I love that, and I couldn't agree more. And one of the things that I mentioned drew me into you was around an article you wrote for Forbes Coaches Council on the neuroscience of our head, heart, and gut brains. Can you tell us a little bit about how our brains and our bodies come into play in terms of what you said of getting in our way or preventing us from wanting to create change?
Absolutely. I was very fortunate. I think I was actually in the last class that Judith Glasser taught from start to end before she passed away several years ago. But Judith spent decades of her life researching conversational intelligence, the neuroscience of conversation, and really learned a lot from her in that regard. And we can come back and talk about some of that. But I noticed on one of her graphics, she had this little line coming from the brain down into the body and a little heart. And I asked her, what is that? And she said, oh, that's the heart brain. That's not what I study. I can't really tell you a whole lot about it. That got me curious. And so I began to do a lot of research, and I have continued to do research and study about the neuroscience of our brain. And the article I wrote really introduces the three brains. The head brain, which is the cephalic brain, the heart brain, which is the cardiac brain, and the gut brain, which is the enteric brain. In our hearts and in our guts are the same motor neurons and sensory neurons as in our heads. In our hearts and in our guts are the same electrochemical activity as in our heads. And these three, and not every neuroscientist calls it a brain. Some will talk about a neural cluster or neural network, but they all agree those neurons are there and they're acting. And they each have their own role. And none of this is surprising, but it validates so much of what we instinctively know. Our cardiac brain, our heart brain, is about passion. It's about compassion. It's about values. The gut brain, which actually stretches from the esophagus all the way through the digestive tract, has about as many neurons as a cat's brain. And it is the seat of courage. Do you have the guts to take this new challenge on? We talk about these things. They're true. The enteric brain, the gut brain, is the seat of courage. It's the seat of self-protection. Something in my gut tells me I should leave this situation. And it's the seat of who we are at our core. The three brains communicate through the vagus nerve, and the vagus nerve's cellular structure is such that the neuroscientists believe about 90% of the communication is upward. So we put language to what our gut is telling us. We put language to what our heart is telling us. And sometimes we say, I don't have the words for it. I just know. The cephalic brain, the head, the brain in our heads, is where that reasoning comes in, where that language, where the problem solving, the creative thinking, if you will, come in. All of this is important. And then I'll stop talking. All of this is important because of our relationship to story. And story is how we can best begin to move through the most difficult changes we're facing.
I want to get into that in a second, but I want to highlight, because I think the first time I heard that the gut brain is the same size as a cat's brain was a pretty profound understanding of just how many neurons that means exist within our gut. And likewise, I think I heard recently that if you were to stretch our gut brain out, it's as big as two tennis courts. And so if you think about how much information our guts are taking in from our environment, from everything we're experiencing, we're breathing, we're eating, we're encountering, there's a lot of data coming in and being processed on what many would call a non-conscious level, right? It's not part of our head brain. It's not part of our conscious thinking, but we're bringing in all of that information and then our head has to process it. So I want you to elaborate a little bit on the last thing you said around the story and how that becomes so important as it relates to change.
I'm going to come back to that in just a minute, sure. Jessica, because you said something that's also very relevant, very important. I've seen different numbers. The most frequent is we receive 11 million bits of data a second. Mm-hmm. 11 million. Now, I've seen some reports that say it's something less than that, some that say it's something more than that, but it's in the millions range. And that's important. That's bits of data a second, because virtually all the research says we can process about 134 of those bits of data every second. So exactly what you're talking about, it's our unconscious that decides what gets through to our conscious. Out of that 11 million, 8 million, 19 million, whatever number you want to use.
Right.
140 bits get through. So let's go to story. We had story before we had language. We drew stories in the dirt. We painted stories on hides and cave walls. The human brain is a story processor. Those of us who work in business, who make business decisions, we want to think that our best capability is our logic. It's not. It's story. One of the interesting things about the brain and story is the brain can't tell the difference between story and reality. So if you think about those great movies that you watch that have you sitting at the edge of your seat or feeling the emotion of the actresses and the actors on the screen, or the plays, or even stories that are told through music, our bodies are responding to those stories as if we are in that lived event. And again, there's neuroscience there. They do fMRIs of people experiencing something, people hearing the story about experiencing something. The patterns are virtually identical. So the way to use your three brains, the way to use story, the way to change the filters in your unconscious is by creating a story about the change. But you don't create a story about what it will be like when you have successfully completed the change. And I'm going to come back and give a real life example of one of my clients. The story you want is a story not about the future, but a story from the future. Stories about the future are up in our heads. Stories from the future are head, heart, gut stories. And again, the brain can't tell the difference. So as we tell ourselves this story from the future over and over again, as we maybe enact pieces of it physically even, we are building new neural networks. We are laying new patterns in our unconscious so that when we run into those obstacles, our unconscious says, wait a minute. There's got to be a way under, around, through, over this, because I know what it's like on the other side. So real quick example, former client of mine, now a very good friend of mine, was laid off in her mid-50s. Her husband was laid off about the same time. It was in the middle of the housing crisis. Second marriage for both. They owned two homes. They decided that over the next 5 years, somehow they wanted to retire and move to Costa Rica. Now, that meant selling two houses in the midst of the housing crisis. It meant learning Spanish. It meant divesting of most of their property. It meant figuring out how they were going to maintain family relationships with their children and their grandchildren and all of those kinds of things. Really big change. The head story is, in 5 years, we are going to have to figure out how to sell two houses, blah, 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 blah. And so why don't we just move to Florida? Their story began, we did it. We woke up this morning in our new apartment on the Pacific Ocean in Costa Rica. The ocean breezes blowing through the windows. We can hear the chatter of Spanish down on the streets below. We had to sell two houses in the middle of the housing crisis and learn Spanish, blah, 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 blah. And here we are. it didn't happen in 5 years. It happened in three.
What a beautiful example. What a beautiful example of the power of the stories and how they either become our reality or they don't, right? They either help us progress or get in our way. I'm curious, as you've worked with lots of individuals and coached in coaching and in various roles that you've performed, have you seen a shift? Have you seen anything change from how people have existed maybe in the past to where they're at today? And what are you seeing as some of those biggest challenges that people are facing today as they try to live their lives in the best way that they can?
I think COVID was a catalyst. It was a catalyst for change that a lot of people saw bubbling up and sometimes popping up above the surface and often being held down. But it was a change where people began to realize that there was a different way of relating the work they were doing with the rest of the life that they were living. It was a change that saw people say, I don't even know why I'm doing what I'm doing, because there's no meaning for me. I have no passion about this. I don't, you know, yes, I'm feeding my family. Yes, I'm feeding my ego. I'm not feeding my soul. I'm not feeding my spirit. And so my perspective on where we are is that we are in the early stages. We have not settled from the impact of COVID on the future of work. We are in the early stages of totally redefining our culture. And I'm talking globally, our culture around people and work.
So what does that look like? What does... And I talk about this a lot from an evolving workplaces standpoint and the need to really transform our workplaces if we're going to live better lives as human beings. And I'm curious what that looks like. What are some of those changes that have to come to the workplace? And 2-3 years ago, I remember hearing the future of work, right? There was all this talk about the future of work. And I joke now, like, it's not the future, it's right now and the future. It's both. It's now and into the future. But what are some of those changes that you're seeing really need to start taking root, that organizations really need to be paying attention to, or there may be longer term consequences?
So let me begin with the end in mind again, that story from the future. I really believe that the future of work will be the digital equivalent of the agrarian age. Work will be completed by those who are skilled to complete it where they are when it needs to be done. And so stepping that back, what does that mean today? It means we need leaders, not just servant leaders. There's a great value in servant leadership. We need enlightened leaders. We need leaders who build relationships with people, not with employees. We need leaders who recognize that what is important is that the work gets done, and the work gets done with quality, not when it gets done, not where it gets done, not how it gets done. We need leaders who can build environments that are not just physically, but psychologically safe for everyone, regardless of any aspect of how they are the same and or different from those around them. So it starts with leadership. And for me, I'm really changing my vocabulary. So I talk about people, not employees, not human resources. Now, all of those are replaceable cogs in the machine. People are not. We need to think about what work means in the greater picture of people's lives. And actually, 2 weeks after COVID shut the world down or shut the United States down, a colleague and I received a trademark. And we had applied for it late in 2019. It came through toward the end of March in 2020. And the trademark that we hold here in the United States is 4-day work week. I think 4-day work week is a part of the future of work. But what's important is we do not mean Monday through Thursday. We do not mean Tuesday through Friday or Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. A 4-day work week for us is fit to the work that needs to be done. So if you and I are working in the same office, Jessica, or maybe even not in the same office, but for the same company, for you, a 4-day work week might mean Monday through Thursday because you share responsibilities for caring for an older parent. And you take Fridays to do that so that you still have your weekend. For me, a 4-day work week might mean I come in, not physically necessarily even, but I come into work. I start my work at the same time as you. But I stop at 3 o'clock in the afternoon because my kids are getting home from school and I want to be a part of their afternoon activities and lives. And so I'm working 5 days a week. I think that's a piece of the future of work. Again, fit to achieve what has to be done when it has to be done. But blend, again, change in my vocabulary, not work-life balance anymore, but work-life blending to do the job and live the life that people want to live.
I think that's so powerful and so impactful when it comes to looking at life as the life I want to live, the experience that I want to have. And for so long, everybody talked about work-life balance, and it's really a misnomer anyway, right? We only get one life. And I think as you talk about people going through COVID, that was certainly my lived experience, right? I'm a mom. I've got a 7-year-old boy and I've got 4-year-old girls. So during COVID, my girls were 9 months old. They're twins. And so you can imagine what life was like with twin 9-month-olds. And at the time, my son was 4 and 2 working parents and trying to manage all the things that you had to manage. And so I think it's that lived experience. And I agree with you that as we went through COVID and we lived through that experience, that brought this sense of awareness of, I really only have this one life. And because it blended so much more together, because it wasn't so separate, it created this sense of awareness of how will I live it with intention? How will I live it on purpose in a way that creates meaning and joy and allows me to enjoy the experiences rather than trying to work towards some destination that we all know. We've heard the stories of people looking back on their life and nobody looks back on their life and thinks, man, I wish I had worked a few more hours every day. That's not the thing that you long for. So instead of looking for that destination, how do we enjoy our experience? How do we enjoy that journey? And today, and I was just talking to somebody this morning in the corporate space who has an organization that's still very entrenched in practices of the 2000s, of the traditional, if you've got tattoos, you got to cover them up, that kind of mentality or a policy-based organization. And I think that there are quite a few leaders out there because they've gotten to those positions and they've had a very different experience in terms of their career journey and what got them to those leadership roles. And making that shift or making that change from what used to be to what maybe needs to be now can be really difficult. And I think we've seen examples in the news of different leaders pulling back, trying to go back to the way things were, or how do we get people to go back to understanding a mode that's very different than the 4-day week you describe, right? Very different from that level of flexibility. How do you, as you work with leaders, help them to make that shift? And how do we create that transition to get out of the, this is the way it always was, to it can be different. It can look different in the future.
One of the people I have a great deal of respect for. I've had a few conversations with him. Is Chris DeSantis. Chris is the author of the book, Why I Find You Irritating. And it's a book about intergenerational conflict at work. And in one of our conversations, Chris said something that is so obvious and yet so brilliant that we don't pay attention to. And it's something that I work with my leaders that I'm coaching to help them pay attention to. He said, we raise our children to belong in their generation. And then when they get into the workplace, we expect them to comply with the mores and culture of our generation. And his biggest advice and part of being an enlightened leader is be curious, ask questions, and shut up. Listen to your workers. They'll tell you what they need to be successful on your behalf.
So it takes that trust to trust people with that their ability to make those decisions, right?
Absolutely. And what's so astonishing, Jessica, is I don't know how many clients have said to me, wait a minute. You trusted me for a year. You trusted me for 2 years without ever being physically in your presence. I hit all the numbers. I produced all the reports or all of the whatevers. Why don't you trust me now? And if you don't trust me now, why should I trust you now?
What do you think is at the root of that? What do you think is at the root of that distrust or that inability to recognize the progress that was made and appreciate that? Why do you think there is that push?
I think often, in all candor, I think often it's ego, it's fear. I think there's a lot of fear. And I'll pick on Elon Musk. He's far from the only leader.
But he can take it. He's built multi-billion dollar businesses. He can take a little criticism.
He's not the only leader who has displayed some form of this. But he said, if you're working for me, you're going to be in the office at least 40 hours a week or go steal time from somebody else. What does that say to me about how much you trust me? And oh, by the way, what says because I'm sitting at a desk in an office that I'm working? Anyone who has worked in an office for 2 weeks knows those players who show up before the boss shows up and read the newspaper and do the crossword puzzles and stand around and gab and then wait to leave until the boss leaves, not because they're working, but because they're trying to win points, to make an impression. If you don't trust me, I'm not going to trust you. And when we look at things like employee engagement, when we look at, McKinsey did a study a couple of years ago now, what were the driving forces behind the Great Resignation? And what did leaders think those driving forces were? The disconnect is astonishing. What were the driving forces behind the Great Resignation? Among the top ones, I don't feel valued by my manager. I don't feel valued by my employer. If you don't trust me, you don't value me. And if you don't value me, why should I be giving everything I can to make you successful?
Well, and I think what's so interesting about that too is when you think about an absence of trust, and we go back to the head, heart, and gut brains, and that our gut brain is responsible for self-preservation and safety, that if I don't trust you, if I have fear or if I have mistrust in play, then our gut brain is also responsible for taking action, right? For mobilization. So now I've just immobilized the people that I want to be performing, the people that I want to be contributing. I've actually de-incentivized them on not even necessarily a conscious level, but a subconscious level to not perform at my best.
You are so on point on that. Again, a little bit of neuroscience. Trust is centered in our prefrontal cortex. Distrust is actually centered in the reptilian brain, the amygdala. And we are built for distrust, by the way. We are built for protecting ourselves. The amygdala is the seat of fight, flight, freeze, appease. It takes a tenth of a second to trigger the prefrontal cortex. Oops, 300ths of a second less, 700ths of a second to trigger the amygdala. So when you're triggering that fight, flight, freeze, appease, or when you're triggering that distrust, it literally blocks access. The electrochemical activity, depending on how strong it gets, can totally block access to the prefrontal cortex, can totally block the communication from the gut and from the heart.
And what I love about that too, I'm going to go back to something you said much earlier around the language that we use and calling people instead of employees. And I think it's a good example of just that subtle difference of if I'm calling you my employees versus my people, if I know your name and your life and I know something about you versus I know just the job that you perform for my company. And that even those subtle nuances of the language that you're using or how much you have an understanding of someone is going to, again, activate that ability to engage in the people that you're working with. And then that's going to affect how much energy they give you, how much they're able to perform. And again, not even on a conscious level, which I think is the important part in my mind for leaders to appreciate and to take away, is that their actions, their behaviors, their choices in terms of how they communicate, what policies they put in place, how they craft or shape their workplace culture is going to impact people on subconscious levels. And it's going to change that the actions and the choices that they make, irregardless of whether they consciously want to be serving you well or not, they may still respond in these pre-programmed fight or flight type, not may, they will, because it is at that biological subconscious level.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I wanted to spend just a couple of minutes on trust.
Yeah.
Because trust is at the heart of every relationship we have, personal, professional, social, it doesn't matter. And this is one of the most important lessons that I learned from Judith Glasser. She has a model for building and sustaining trust. The acronym is TRUST. For me, it's the only acronym in my vocabulary because there's nothing secret about it. The first T is transparency. And we all know what transparency means. What most people miss about transparency is we're not transparent about what we need from the other. R is relationship. That's seeing the world through the other's eyes. That's, again, recognizing that when I call a daily meeting at 8 a.m., even if it's virtual, the Jessicas of the world who are trying to get their kids out the door to school aren't present. They're torn between their personal responsibilities and the professional expectations we're putting on them. So R is about relationship. U is understanding. That's that understanding that comes from deep listening, from being curious, from getting to know what's important about the other person and in the other person's lives. S is shared success. Again, most of our listeners, if not all of them, have been in those meetings where we spend a lot of time making sure we agree on the words so we can all go off and give them our own meaning. that doesn't get you shared success. Shared success is those tough conversations that bring you to shared meaning and alignment and support behind that. And then the last T is telling the tough truths with candor and caring. That's what it takes to build and sustain trust.
I really love that acronym for remembering it, the transparency relationship, understanding, shared success, and telling the tough truths. I have to believe, actually, in just looking at it, that the last one is probably the most difficult for people, that really getting good at how I communicate those tough truths and do so in a way that builds up rather than breaks down, I think can be a stumbling block for a lot of leaders. Have you seen that?
It is. And so I tend to see two patterns. I avoid it until I'm ready to explode, or I'm just so in your face that all you want to do is run and hide, and you don't really hear what I'm saying. And so the way that I will often coach leaders on that is to approach those tough truths from a position of curiosity. Jessica, the report that I asked you to get for me, to complete for me today, you didn't get done. And I'm really wondering what happened. What could I do to make help you make sure it doesn't happen again? Because my boss is on me now. There's a tough truth there. But it, again, approaches Jessica the person, not, why'd you screw up again, Jessica?
Right.
Or something a little more violent than that.
Yeah, or worse, which sends the receiver into that shutdown mode.
Exactly,
now
exactly.
I need to protect myself. And what do I have to do to protect myself? And when we're protecting ourselves is not when we are engaged in collaborative win decision-making. We've moved out of that state, right?
I was just had a conversation not too long ago with Chris Seymour, who is a senior vice president at Boise Cascade. He was telling a story of, I think he said he was about 25. He was working for another company at the time, was running a project that he ran in excess of $1 million over budget. And he got called into headquarters, and it was not like down the road. He had to fly in. He said, Chris is a great storyteller. He said, I had to put on my Sunday best. I couldn't eat the night before. I was so nervous. I had to see the vice president. I was sure I was getting fired. And so he went in, and the vice president approached from a position of curiosity and asked what happened, what went wrong. They went through that whole exploration, if you will. And the vice president said, okay. And Chris said, what do you mean, okay? Aren't you going to fire me? And he said, why would I fire you? He said, because I ran this project $1 million over budget. He said, the vice president said, is this the first time you ran a project of this size? He said, yeah. So you were inexperienced. Now you have experience. Where experience comes from? Inexperience. Use those opportunities to help people grow, not to shut them down.
I think that as we've talked about these challenges, we focused on the leadership component, which of course is where you want to start, because they are the shapers of culture and those that can create the change within organizations. If you were to offer, though, advice to those that are maybe in positions or situations where they don't have that same level of influence or they don't have that same opportunity to bring change, what are some things that can help them? Are there any really strong strategies or techniques that they can use as they're navigating the changes in their life, as they're trying to navigate the changes in the workplaces and their interactions with all these different leaders?
I think the most important, and step back for one moment, manager is another word that I'm sweeping away. because even if you have frontline employees reporting to you, you're a leader in today's workplace. Even if you are a frontline employee, take responsibility for your life. For all of us, what that means is have a growth mindset. Spend time with ourselves, reflecting. Very often when someone comes to me and says, I want to make a big change in my life, they'll say, I know I don't want to be doing what I'm doing anymore. I don't know what it is that's next for me. And my question is, what makes your heart sing? How do you connect with that passion? How does the work that you're doing, if you're a baggage handler, or if you're a train conductor or engineer, how does the work that you're doing connect to the purpose that your organization exists to fill? Find that line of sight. Find what it is that gives you meaning and gives you purpose. Find the way to bring what's important to you into your life every day. Build trust with the people around you. Earn their trust. And the way you do that, you don't say, why don't you trust me? Because now I'm putting you on defensive again. You don't trust me. Ask, what can I do to strengthen your trust in me? I had one client, a very successful salesperson, that heard that not too long ago in a group coaching session I was doing. He went out to his best customer and had a trust conversation. And what they discovered is they actually trust one another a lot more than the roles they were playing and the games they were playing with each other. So again, transparency.
Yeah, it comes back to those same principles. Yeah. No matter what it is you're doing, seeing yourself from that lens or through that lens, and then applying those strategies so that you can build that trust amongst all relationships. I love that. And I love that you're looking at how to do away with that term manager, because I don't know that when we created the term manager, it was to manage the activities or the tasks or the things that are getting done. And today, with the way things have gone and the levels of technology, each individual person is really a manager of their, absolutely, of the work that they're doing and they're accomplishing. And yeah, I think that's fantastic.
The last piece, again, wherever you sit in an organization, wherever you sit in your life, pay attention to the stories you're telling yourself. We are all fascinating, fantastic storytellers, even those of us who say we're not. Because we tell ourselves, we're talking to ourselves 24 hours a day. We're telling ourselves stories. We're believing them, and they determine how we're living our lives. And we're all telling ourselves stories that are not serving us and those around us very well. And you can change those stories. And if you change those stories, you can change your life.
I love that. I remember the first time I heard Cy Wakeman, who's a friend of mine and wrote Reality-Based Leadership and Reality-Based Rules of the Workplace. And she talked about, and I heard her on stage talking about those stories that we tell ourselves and how impactful that was to wake up and recognize that we're often caught in stories that we don't have to be caught in. And if we can identify them as that, we can really make lasting change in our lives for both us and for the people that we lead and that we support. So, Brian, I want to thank you for coming on today. I want to give you a chance to share any final words of wisdom or thoughts or insights that you want to share with our audience as we wrap up this episode.
I'm not sure I have anything specific that I haven't already said to share at this time. Just live your best life.
Absolutely. And that is the core premise of this podcast and of what we focus on at Evolving to Exceptional, which is to just always focus on how we can be evolving, growing, expanding, changing so that we can live our best life, so that we can live a truly exceptional life that's filled with exceptional experiences on our performance journey. This has been a great conversation, Brian. I appreciate all the perspective on the head, heart, and gut brains and how those come into play in the corporate context, as well as the things and changes that need to happen in our workplaces and with our leaders. As I always wrap up every episode, I want to just remind our listeners to always keep evolving, keep growing, keep expanding, keep changing, keep rewiring those neural pathways so that you truly can live your best life and enjoy all the experiences that you have on your performance journey. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and we'll be back again next week.